of Professor Asad Abu Khalil, the very, very well-known and famous professor of political science at California State University Stanislaus, as well as visiting professor of political science at UC Berkeley. He is an internationally recognized figure on Al Jazeera and throughout the Arab world, political commentator of such high standing that, you know, people listen to what Asad has to say. And His blog, the Angry Arab blog, which we'll get the exact website later, is probably one of the most read blog sites in the U.S. So welcome to Arab Talk, Asad. We're very lucky and pleasure. It's a pleasure having you here.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Jess and Jamal.
So we were going to discuss various issues. And, of course, just like, I don't know, a miracle or whatever happened. So the big story, we always go through the big story. The big story of the day is the killing of al-Zarqawi. Right. Now, the way it has been presented, especially on American media, it reminded me going back to the capture of Saddam Hussein, like they're waiting for something, and we got him, and now everything is going to be hunky-dory, right? What is your reaction to this?
Well, I think I was quite amazed at the way that the media were playing it up. I was most surprised to see the president of the United States, the head of a very proud and arrogant empire, made a special speech about Zarqawi's capture. And I thought to myself, there's something very ironic here. I mean, here is the mightiest, only superpower left today, which has thousands, tens of thousands of troops in Iraq, which has used massive violence in Iraq, and yet it's celebrating the capture of a little town criminal turned bloody terrorist in Iraq by the name of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. But the thing is, like, I've seen this show before. There were cases when we heard about, once we get Qusay Saddam Hussein, that the insurgency is going to be nipped in the bud. Or if we get his other brother, Uday, or once we capture Saddam. In fact, I remember when they captured Saddam and they were engaged in all this self-congratulations, they said that they found on Saddam a briefcase. And the briefcase contains all the secret codes about the insurgency. And once we get to it, it's all going to be over. I heard the same thing today. They said that they found in that little place in Baquba a treasure trove of information and data. I mean, it seems to me...
Before they said they also found his computer, laptop.
Right, remember? Right, right. And the thing is, like, I mean, this is an indication not of their competence, of their utter incompetence, that they genuinely... I think that they are dumb enough to really believe what they are telling us. They really think that if you get to this point... And I think U.S. commanders on the ground know what we all know, which is that Zarqawi did not have much of control of all what's going on in Iraq. In fact, last month, one of the highest months of attacks on U.S. troops, and most of these attacks were not car bombs, were these like improvised explosives on the road. And they are all orchestrated by little cells that have nothing to do with Zarqawi. If anything, I can make the argument that the resistance movement in Iraq is going to improve its image now that Zarqawi is killed, because they don't have the stigma or the association with Zarqawi. They can now say that we can focus all our energies and attacks on U.S. And, of course, there are other troops, Macedonian troops,
and
who are occupying the
country. For our listeners, that stigma is that Zarqawi has been attacking mosques indiscriminately.
Right. I mean, Zarqawi has... I mean, Zarqawi...
But is there evidence for that, Asad, that he was the one behind
yes.
attacks in the masajid?
Right,
in
right. I am of the view that certainly Zarqawi is a notorious bloody terrorist who have engaged in killing of so many innocent people throughout Iraq. And in fact, I mean, I've read his speeches, I've heard his speeches, I've read some of the information that his groups put out, and there's no question about that. Having said that, I mean, the United States think that they are pulling such a propaganda extravaganza today. Unbeknownst to them, most people of the Arab world, and I disagree with that, do not believe that Zarqawi exists as a person. Most of them believe that he is an invention of the CIA's psychological operations. So now that they have all this picture of his bloated face, it's only going to reinforce his suspicions. They're going to say America invented the myth and America killed the myth in order to create such a victory for themselves.
What do you think about, I read something today, from Human Rights Watch, or that this is a violation of the Geneva Convention. I mean, this is only in the two cases or three cases where the U.S. first killed Qusay, you know, and displayed the two brothers' picture, Uday and Qusay, on a bed with their body riddled
after reconstituting their faces.
And exactly. Right. And then they had also Saddam Hussein, who's the prisoner. And then today they showed
checkup.
And today they showed Zarqawi, and they're saying that, you know, this is really unusual. This is a violation of Geneva that you are displaying.
No. But to be fair to the United States, Jamal, the United States is totally in favor of international law and morality, provided it doesn't apply to its occupation troops. I mean, the United States on the International Criminal Court is very much in favor of the International Criminal Court, provided it doesn't apply to U.S. occupation troops. The same thing about this. The United States does not believe those rules apply to the United States. This is why Democrats and Republicans in Congress are all in unison in favor of supporting the right of U.S. occupation troops to commit war crimes. That's where we live in.
So, Assad, what's your analysis of what impact do you think this will have on the resistance in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Absolutely little, if anything. There is a possibility this going to instigate a momentum, largely because many people in Iraq are going to look at the insurgency as a movement that is not has the stigma of Zarqawi. But having said that, I am not of the view that Zarqawi single-handedly, not only, I mean, he is not responsible for the insurgency as a whole, but he is not single-handedly responsible for the Sunni Shiite killings in the country. There are so many organizations responsible. I think when we speak about the Sunni Shiite semi-civil war going on today, we have to blame it on the long years of Saddam's tyranny and manipulation. We have to blame it on American sectarian manipulation after they occupied the country. And thirdly, we have to blame it also on the thuggish killing that have taken place at the hand of Shiite militias, the Badr militias against Sunni, and other groups. So, I mean, it seems to me in a historical perspective, if we are analyzing American occupation in Iraq, this is a false watershed. This is purely a political event that is exploited by a president desperate for any victory from anywhere and hoping to lift up his sagging political fortunes.
That's the voice of Professor Assad Abu Khalil, professor of political science at California State University, Stanislaw. If you'd like to ask him a question directly, you can call our line at 415-346-5376. Let me just kind of push this a little bit. And I think it will be good for our listeners, Assad, to get kind of the larger political context of what's happening in Iraq right now. President Bush today said that clearly this is, you know, as Jamal said, this is a watershed. This is a turning point. We're in the right direction now. But where on the apex, where are we, do you see, just in terms of the larger kind of occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan and Palestine? Where do you see the forces going in the larger picture?
It seems to me, I mean, it's all over. I mean, I think the United States has lost in Iraq and increasingly in Afghanistan. In the case of Iraq, the United States has lost. The United States has lost by virtue of the realization that there is no winning scenario for the United States in Iraq. The United States loses if it stays in Iraq, and the United States loses if it leaves in Iraq. So, I mean, this is why they are really stuck. And I am of the opinion, I disagree with many other colleagues, that the United States will be leaving Iraq much sooner than all the triumphalist statements would like us to believe. A lot of people are saying, but they are building the most massive, biggest embassy there is. That is true, but it's also true that the United States is affected by domestic public opinion, which is building largely so much fiercely in opposition to this war. And America's clients in Iraq, the one that they hope will lead the country, have not been able to achieve any popular support.
We're going to take a caller on the line. Caller, what's your question to Dr. Assad Abu Khalil?
Hello?
Hello? Yes, do you have a question?
Yes, I was calling in to ask the professor a question about, with respect to the U.S. occupation in Iraq, so many people who are now recognizing the mistake of the invasion claim that an immediate withdrawal would lead to even more chaos.
So your question, you're trying to say if they withdraw, all hell will break loose, therefore the U.S. must stay there?
What's your assessment of that, Asa? That's an excellent question, actually.
I get asked that throughout the country whenever I speak about this subject, because I am of the opinion that the United States should unconditionally and immediately withdraw its troops from Iraq, as well as the 38 soldiers from Macedonia, because it's supposedly a multinational force. And to that I say two things. The first one is, no, things couldn't get worse than what we have today already. And the second answer to that, and we should all of us in the progressive community in America insist on it, the dispute over self-determination, I mean, this is a dispute that has been settled in a previous century. If you are of the opinion that the Iraqis should have the self-determination, that we should not equivocate when we speak about the need for an immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq.
Another caller here on the line. What's your question?
Yes, I think we have another call. Caller, do you have a question for Dr. Abu Khalil?
Yes, I do.
What's your question?
The question is, if there was a unified effort, is this war producing a United States of the Arab countries in a way that the United States was founded out of a revolutionary war? Could it be that it's going to produce a United States of the Middle East?
Well, I mean, you would be surprised that there is, in fact, in the Middle East today, a unanimity of public opinion that is much more united than the media would like us to believe. I mean, yes, there are all these feuds between the various royal families and dynasties, or most of whom are clients of the United States. But in reality, I mean, as far as public opinion are concerned, and we have many surveys about that, we find that the Arab people are united on many questions about Palestine, about American occupation of Iraq, about the need to restrain this, you know, unrestrained U.S. empire in the world, and on and on.
I think we have another caller, Jamal. I know you and I would like to ask Assad a bunch of questions, but we have another caller. Caller, do you have a question for Dr. Abu Khalil?
Yes, I do.
What's your question?
Can you comment, please, on Zbigniew Brzezinski's book, Grand Chessboard, which came out, I believe, late 90s as a prelude to the particular invasion and the things that are happening in the Middle East, and how that's playing into what's going on, and how will that continue?
Thank you for your question. Assad, what do you think?
I missed...
Brzezinski, his
book from the 90s.
Right. I missed what he wanted to know about that book.
What impact, do you think, what relevance does that book have for what's going on?
Zbigniew Brzezinski, whether in that book as well as in his other recent writings, including his last book after that, he is not opposed to the U.S. empire. And let us remember his tenure, which is quite unsavory when he was National Security Advisor to the Clinton administration, when he raised that famous slogan, bye-bye PLO, and of course the Palestinian did not go away and will not go away. I think that he believes that the empire, the United States empire, is now blundering. And this is going to harm American interests. And I think from an American imperial point of view, he's correct. There are many people who are concerned because at the helm of the American empire is somebody who is so incompetent and he's so ill-prepared and he's quite uninformed about all world affairs. But it seems to me this is something where those of us who are opposed to the U.S. empire should take some hope from. In other words, I am on the long term pleased that U.S. empire had somebody as incompetent as Bush as its helm, as opposed to somebody like Clinton, because it's going to expedite the retreat of U.S. empire, certainly from the Middle East. I think that what happened in Iraq is going to restrain any desires that any American officials may have against Iran against
right.
Syria, and against other places.
We're going to take a short break. I just want to remind all our listeners, the number is 415-346-5376. And you're listening, right? Welcome back. You're listening to Arab Talk with Jason Jamal on KPOO 89.5 FM. I think we also have another phone call, and then we'll switch gears right there.
Okay, caller, do you have a question for Professor Abu Khalil?
Yes. My name is Paul Kangas. I'm asking, what would happen if Saddam Hussein was released? Would he be able to reorganize Iraq in a more secular, stabilized environment?
Professor?
He was released.
It's ironic that you say that.
Good question.
Because I wrote today on my blog, there is an Arabic newspaper widely read, which reported just yesterday that the rumors in the streets of Baghdad are that the United States is secretively negotiating for the return of Saddam Hussein to power. I'm not saying that this report is credible or whether it's true or not. I don't think it's likely that it is true. But having said that, I think that all of us who care about human rights and about freedom for the Iraqi people, real freedom, not Bush's promises of freedom, false freedom, should totally, fiercely oppose any return to Saddam Hussein to power. I mean, this man is responsible for so many violations of human rights and atrocities that we should, you know, unequivocally object to that idea.
But then Maliki says he will use the iron fist to come down on the people of Basra.
I mean, if you ask my opinion about these people in power today, I mean, there's no question that some of them have bloods on their hands, and some of them have engaged, especially around the Badr militia types, have killed a lot of innocent Iraqis and a lot of innocent Palestinians. I mean, the Badr militia has persecuted. This is something that you don't see in the press.
Mm-hmm.
The Palestinians in Iraq, this is a law-abiding, peaceful community, have been persecuted. Some of them have been expelled from the country for no reason because they have this very false association between the Palestinians and Saddam Hussein.
Switching gears, Haditha. I want to remind our listeners. Right. Now, the incident of killing Zarqawi today, is this going to... Basically, I mean, from my perspective as a journalist, the administration is going to take full advantage to try to cover up, to try to have the people forget about the atrocities committed by the U.S. Marines.
Well, you're absolutely right, and that's the nature of the media, and I dare say of public opinion in America. Now that Zarqawi has been captured, all will be forgiven and all will be forgotten. All these human rights violations in Haditha and elsewhere, all these innocent Iraqis. I mean, on average, there are hundreds of innocent Iraqis who are killed at American checkpoint. Not to mention the fact, I mean, look at the capture of Zarqawi today.
Killing of Zarqawi.
The killing of Zarqawi. I mean, look at the logistics of it. I mean, they flew fighter jets. They used missiles. I mean, the whole might of the American armed forces are used against this criminal terrorist who came from a little town in Jordan. I mean, it shows you that America and Iraq today, as an occupying power, is subject to no legal or moral restraint whatsoever.
So do you feel this is like their get-out-of-jail card? Zarqawi gave them today the get-out-of-jail card?
But even before Zarqawi, I was rather very, I mean, I shouldn't say surprised, but dismayed, the extent to which there was very little public outcry, not to mention media outcry, about this really horrible massacre in Haditha. Of all the newspapers which covered it, the only one which gave a whole graphic description of what these really allegedly war criminals have done was in the Los Angeles Times. When you hear the account of the survivors, the Arabic media have done a much better job of covering it, I should say.
But you know, the thing, ironically, Assad, about that in the American media, what they're concerned about was there a cover-up or not, the intensity of the war crimes.
Hold that thought for me, we have a caller on the line.
Okay, we have a caller, so let's see. I think we're having too many calls from the CIA today. Actually, I want to switch gears a little bit, Jamal. Hold on. I want to ask Assad Abu Khalil a very important question. We're going to switch a little bit. We're going to try to cover as much of the Arab world as possible. I want to ask about the recent events in Lebanon. Pete, you're not hearing about it in the corporate media. There's a lot going on. Can you give our listeners an idea about some riots that occurred in Beirut recently?
Right. I mean, you're right about it. Suddenly how the media a year ago were all about Lebanon, all about this so-called revolution, because the media was so eager to try to validate the Bush doctrine. They wanted to see that the victory that eluded them in Iraq was captured over there in Lebanon's little country. A year later, Lebanon has disappeared. Why? Because developments in Lebanon are running counter to the Bush doctrine, and America has discovered, despite their manipulation, despite the propaganda, it is not going according to the plan. What you are referring to last week occurred because a right-wing, very sectarian Lebanese station, which hires only Christian with a very long record of insensitivity to the poor and to Muslims in Lebanon, did I don't want to say satirical because it's a very unsophisticated kind of comedy show in which they lampooned the leader of Hezbollah. I mean, personally, I am in favor of mocking everybody. But the riots did not occur because the cleric, the head of Hezbollah, was mocked. They were rioting because they felt the straw that broke the camel back, that this right-wing radio station, which have such insensitivity to a large section of the population, is really now getting to a point that is offending deep beliefs that many Muslims in Lebanon have.
I want to come back to Lebanon in a second, but we have another call, and hopefully it's someone. You know, I think that let me just push this a little bit more, Assad. Jamal, what do you want to? Because I want to ask him more about Lebanon, because I do think that the situation in Lebanon around the racism issue and what's going on in terms of Palestinian refugees and people like Michelle Aoun coming back to Lebanon, what the heck is going on?
Well, I mean, basically, now that the Syrian troops have left the country, and of course Israel remains in occupation of a large chunk of the Shib'a farms and the Kfar Shuba area in South Lebanon, The Lebanese are now basically resuming what they have excelled in the past, which is the famous long protracted Lebanese civil wars. So this is why all these sectarian and political divisions of Lebanon are coming to the fore. And this is the frustration of the United States. The United States thought that this is an opportunity to try to run a country according to their own plans, to add another country to the long list of client regimes in the region. But Lebanese divisions defy the U.S. will, and the so-called Cedar Revolution did not materialize and did not bear fruit. Yes.
We're going to take a short musical break. You're listening to Arab Talk on KPOO 89.5 FM, and our guest for the entire hour.
All right, welcome back to Arab Talk on KPOO San Francisco 89.5 FM. This is Arab Talk with Jessen Jamal. We have Professor Asad Abu Khalil, Professor of Political Science at California State University Stanislaus, and the author of the popular blog site Angry Arab. The call-in line is 415-346-5376. And Asad, I just want to kind of push it a little bit in terms of Lebanon. Can you help our listeners understand some of the differences, Beirut, south, and the mountains, like some of the political kind of complexities there?
Well, I mean, without pushing our listeners to early sleep, I would say that Lebanon is a very small country, but it's teeming with so many different sects. And the sectarian divisions of Lebanon have been reinforced and augmented over the years by a political system that have been imposed on Lebanon by the French. Unfortunately, the clerics and the priests of Lebanon, the different sects, as well as international outside intervention, have perpetuated a political system that doesn't allow the individual to speak for herself or himself as a human being or as a citizenship. As a result, sectarian identities have superseded the identities of nationhood. And the nation of Lebanon was created as an idea for Maronite Christians only. As a result, other Lebanese, who are now certainly the overwhelming majority, because the French assumed that the Maronites will continue to be the single largest sect, and now they are down to like third or fourth. So there is a rising Muslim majority that have over the years felt that they didn't have a say in the political system. Of course, the political system has been revised now, but the Lebanese have not changed or altered or diminished their sectarian divisions because the system doesn't allow them to change it. And the Syrian withdrawal have basically brought back all these suppressed animosities between the Lebanese to the fore, and this is why I think the civil war is now resuming. I mean, not necessarily in violent ways, but in political ways,
in identity ways.
And this is why I really believe that Lebanon is on the brink of civil war, and maybe on the brink of civil war for a year or years to come.
Now, this is good because you're talking about the brink of civil war, and we talk about Iraq, brink of civil war. We talk about Palestine, brink of civil war. How does the presence of the United States,
right,
you know, fit in this entire formula? You know, all of a sudden now we have an interest from the U.S. administration in Lebanon.
Well, I think this is a good way to introduce the listeners to the Bush Doctrine. I mean, the Bush Doctrine, aside from the propaganda promises, is one which whenever it enters a country, it pushes it to the verge of civil war. If you look at Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, and Lebanon, every single country where the Bush Doctrine intervened, people are on the verge of civil war. I mean, this is not accidental. And I have to add that Somalia. I mean, Somalia was a situation where we now learn the United States was supporting sides of the warlords. And I have to add this. Not only does America interfere in the civil wars of all these countries and instigate them, but in fact, it is on the side of the most criminal and most violent of all the elements in those countries. And that is true in Somalia, in Lebanon, in Palestine,
Sudan,
in Iraq, in Sudan, as well as in Afghanistan.
I think we have another caller. So hopefully you're not asking for directions, caller. Do you have a question for Professor Asad Abu Khalil?
No, I'm not asking for directions. I'm asking for insight.
Okay, yes.
I appreciate the call. Well, thank you very much.
We have the insight for you here. You know, we have a psychologist here. We have a professor of political science here. And then you have me here
as a wandering journal. No, we have three angry Arabs in the studio. So what's your question, caller?
Um, First of all, I'd like to say that I enjoy reading your blog very much, Professor Asad Abou-Khalil. But one thing I didn't notice, and correct me if I'm wrong, is a...
You're wrong.
is a substantive analysis of the prisoners' document in Palestine. We're shifting gear to Palestine.
Good question.
I was wondering about your thoughts about that. And,
very good
as
question.
As a corollary to that, on the practical side, how do we as Palestinian-American activists who may disagree with points of that document approach... go forward with our disagreement, recognizing
right.
that this is made by people who are in prison while in the comfort of San Francisco.
To be honest, I mean, that's a very good question. I think this is an important development, and I worry that this so-called document is going to be used to crush the democratic will of the Palestinian people in their last election. I mean, there is a conspiracy going on in Palestine, and basically it's being managed by the clients of the Israeli and American occupation. And I'm talking about people like Mohammed Dahlan and the Palestinian president. I mean, the document is a very dangerous document, and for one reason. People, when they are incarcerated, they do not have their free will. And those people who signed this document are in one prison among so many other prisons. Let's remember that thousands of Palestinians are languishing in Israeli jails. We cannot say that some of those who are incarcerated can pretend so arrogantly to speak on behalf of the Palestinian people when the Palestinians made their voices known in the last free election, which resulted in the victory, whether you like it or not, of the Hamas. As far as what we can know, I will tell you that Palestinians in Europe and Arabs and their supporters have been circulating a document, a petition really, in order to voice their opposition to that document and to the idea of referendum, which is going to be used by Abu Mazen in order to wrestle away the voice of the Palestinian people. Similarly, I think we should do something like that here in America to start a petition. I mean, you can start or anybody else in order to oppose this idea.
We have another caller on the line. What's your question, caller?
Do you have a question for Professor Abou-Khalil?
Yes, I do, actually. I wanted to call to ask about Syria, switching gears a little bit. We recently saw a group of Syrian democratic reformers in London meeting, talking about peacefully overthrowing the Syrian regime. I want to know...
Are you talking about reformers under the leadership of that Vice President Khaddam?
The former Vice President of Khaddam, yeah, he defected to France.
Defected, okay.
They like going to France, Assad, for some reason.
But I just wanted to know whether this is a legitimate reform movement. Do you think it's a threat to the Assad regime? And do you see any sort of democratic changes taking place in Syria?
Well, I should state right at the outset that I am no fan. In fact, I am a fierce opponent of every Arab regime bar none, including the Syrians and every other regime. Having said that, the political group that you mentioned that met in London contains so many of the unsavory characters that were part and parcel of the oppressive Syrian regime, most notably, I mean, as Jamal was mentioned, the former vice president, Abdulhalim Khaddam, is part of the power structure and has been since the 1960s. This guy was part of the regime in the 1980s where people were being shot down in the streets of Damascus because they were wearing running shoes or because they were riding motorcycles. Both were considered criminal back in those days. And not to mention, as far as the Syrian public is concerned, Abdulhalim Khaddam is one of the most corrupt individuals to occupy a position of power in the government. And this is why I am not, you know, having any high hopes for that particular group, which met, incidentally, in the Dorchester Hotel, one of the fanciest and most expensive hotels in London.
Doesn't this remind you of the... I learned something living in the United States is the word makeovers, the remaking of Abdulhalim Khaddam, similarly to Allawi and others, where you bring previous thugs and then put them on a pedestal and use them to topple a regime.
But, I mean, in makeovers, people supposedly look better than when they started. In this
These
case,
guys
they
don't look better.
They look worse. I mean, Abdulhalim Khaddam looks uglier than ever.
So I want to bring it back to Palestine. We only have about 10 minutes left, Assad. By the way, this is the voice of Assad Abou-Khalil, professor of political science at California State University. Stanislav, visiting professor of political science at UC Berkeley. If there are any students out there, you must take his classes at Stanislaw or at Berkeley. Let's bring it back to Palestine. Palestine is kind of at the center of a lot of the things. It's the linchpin, if you will, of what's happening in the larger kind of imperial project for the United States right now. Where is Palestine right now in your political analysis? Where are we?
I am most worried about developments in Palestine. And I think this, the case of Palestine, I mean, despite all this gloating on the part of people in the administration about the daily suffering of the Palestinian people, that's what's going on. The United States is starving and punishing the Palestinian people because they voted for the wrong people. I mean, they are being punished because they did not vote for the unsavory crooks and embezzlers and criminals who were supported by the United States government and by Israel. I mean, no matter what you think of Hamas, make no mistake about it, the Palestinians were not voting for a fundamentalist movement. They were voting against the unsavory characters who were running on the Fatah list. And for that reason, I express strong concerns. But on the long run, people are going to use this example to say, the United States does not mean what it says. The United States speaks about democracy, but in actuality, it supports the most unsavory groups and undemocratic, unelected groups and families.
Okay, well, I'll try to translate that for you.
He's calling from a cell phone and driving at the same time.
You know, it's kind of a Northern California thing. Right. But he was saying, when are basically Palestinians and Arabs and the Jewish or Israeli community, how come they can't get along? What is it going to take to have genuine peace?
I mean, when you speak about not getting along, it sends the impression as if it's all about a psychological barrier, as the former Egyptian dictator spoke about Anwar Sadat. In reality, this is very simple. I mean, once Palestinian rights are fully restored, and once a Palestinian state is fully established, and once Palestinian refugees are allowed to return and compensated, it's not either return or compensation, return and compensation, then I think there should be no reason why Israelis and Palestinians, Jews, Muslims, and Christians should not get along in the Holy Land.
We have another caller on the line. Caller, what's your question to Dr. Asad Abu Khalil?
Do you have a question, caller? Hello?
I think we lost this caller.
But let me just further that question, because that's a lot of the what we hear coming out of Washington and the Beltway, Assad, is that they're trying to create dialogue groups, collaborations between Palestinians.
How nice.
Like ATFP and things like that. And as you said, it's as if there's a psychological barrier to getting along rather than, a deep colonizing process that's happening in Palestine.
Let's hold this thought. Let's get this caller question.
I want to get my question in, but do you have a question for Professor Asad Abu Khalil?
Yes, I do.
Yes.
I'm calling from Bakersville, North Carolina. I'm out here in San Francisco, and I spent some time over in Israel 2 years, from 90 to 92. And I'd like to know, in his opinion, what does he think it would take for the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the Muslim world and the U.S. government to ever get along, and does he think that there will ever be a peace between any of these nations?
Well, it seems to me, again, when we think about getting along, we send the impression as if it's a psychological problem, like as if it's like if we only can have two of these people meet in one room, serve them some snacks and beverages, all will be well. No. This is a conflict over real issues, concrete issues of injustice, about an injustice have been committed by actual powers, by Israel and by its allies in the West against a defenseless Palestinian people. Once Palestinian rights are restored, and once a Palestinian state is established, and once there is a secular state in the Holy Land where Jews, Muslims, and Christians can coexist, and once the refugees are allowed to return to their original homes from which they have been expelled in 1948 and 67, then there is no reason why the state of enmity should continue.
Why do you think it is, Assad, that message doesn't seem to be getting across? What's going
on? I think it's part of Israeli propaganda. Israeli propaganda over the years have sent the message that, it is some psychological deficiency that those Arab people have, that they refuse to speak to Israelis, or it is because that they are anti-Semitic. I mean, all these are part and parcel of Israeli propaganda, and they have to be shut down. Not literally.
Yes, but maybe you can just speak, because I know we're kind of firing questions here, but our time is limited. I'm sure we're going to have you back. But what about the recent article that appeared in the London Journal, Review of Books, about the Israeli lobby? There's been a lot written about it. I know you've blogged about it. Maybe you could let our listeners know about that and what your feeling is.
Well, this was a long study which is still available on the website of the Kennedy School of Government of Harvard University, harvard.edu. And it was by two professors. One of them is the dean of the School of Government at Harvard, and the other is a political scientist at the University of Chicago. What is surprising about their credential is that both of them do not come from a left-wing or radical backgrounds whatsoever, and both of them have been very pro-Israeli, and they are supportive of American power over the years. And they wrote a study of the Israeli lobby in which they came to the conclusion that the Israeli lobby exercises tremendous disproportionate power over the making of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and a little bit beyond. Personally, I have been critical of that study. I believe that it tends to narrow down the policy-making process of the U.S. government in the Middle East and beyond. And I don't believe the conclusions reach, which is that as if it's not about American support for Israel, that American foreign policy is all based on the spread of justice and freedom worldwide. In reality, I argue that American support for Israeli violations of human rights is consistent with American support for violations of human rights in so many other places in the world.
Exactly.
This is not a glaring exception. I believe American support for Israel is consistent with the general orientations of American foreign policy. I mean, there are other specific problems, you know, with that study, but I will not mention them now.
You're listening to Dr. Asad Abu Khalil, and I want you to tell us about your blog. What's the website?
Yeah,
there?
Where can people read about
your
work?
The easiest way is you can Google Angry Arab. It will take you there. Or you can type in angryarab.blogspot.com.
And I think we can take one more phone call.
I think
here
we're going to take one more phone call. So, caller, do you have a question for Dr. Abu Khalil?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, what's your question?
By the way, great name for a blog site. This is kind of a wide-ranging question. But is there a view in your guests, or is there a substance to any view that might argue that there is some sort of a chance of there a shift in the pendulum towards a non-sort of sectarian, non-cultural possibility of uniting working people from sort of a traditional leftist viewpoint on in a pan-Arab sense that would come, you know, this was something that, you know, existed in the 50s and 60s, but might come back into play now rather than the current sort of deck of cards that we're dealing with?
Good question.
I'm glad you raised this question, because often when we speak about the Middle East, especially in the Western media, we are left with an impression as if the only ones who operate politically in the region are fundamentalists, Islamic fundamentalists. In reality, there are secular leftists and feminists throughout the region. Whenever I go to Lebanon, I meet with the leaders and members of the Lebanese Communist Party. There are Palestinian communists, Iraqi Communist Party, trade unions. But these people operate on a very strong, at a strong disadvantage. One, they are fought and persecuted by the governments under which they live and suffer. And these governments are operated and supported by the United States and armed. And second, we have to see the legacy of American policies during the Cold War. For the last so many decades, when America was involved against the Soviet Union, Saudi Arabia and America were part of an unholy, horrible alliance, which used to undermine the power of the left throughout the world, including in the Middle East. It was part of that policy that the United States and Saudi Arabia financed, armed, and supported Islamic fundamentalists, including the fanatical ones, from the ranks of which came bin Laden and, yes, Zarqawi.
Which reminds me of something that you've written, and this is going to be the last question, that you said the most important win for Bush, or the end result, will be that he has helped to create and bring back Islamists into the Middle East.
Well, I think he's doing that. And this is why I believe, like, years from now, when people are going to speak about the Bush legacy, it's not going to be about the spread of freedom or democracy. It's really going to be, he's going to be remembered as the president who established the second rule of the Ayatollahs right there in Iraq, next to the second republic, which has the rules of Ayatollah in Iran. And look elsewhere. I mean, in Somalia, because of American false and
misdirected intervention in the Somalian civil war, we have now the rule of the Islamists in Somalia.
That's the voice of Dr. Professor Asad Abu Khalil, professor of political science at California State University Stanislaus, visiting professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. Asad, thank you very, very much with us today. I'm sure we're going to have you back on Arab Talk. And we want to encourage our listeners, if they have any comments about this show, to email Jamal and I at arabtalk@kpoo.com and to also Google Angry Arab. You're going to be able to read a political analysis about what's happening in the Arab world.
And quickly.
But from an Arab perspective, Jamal, from an authentic Arab perspective rather than an Orientalist point of view.
And for our listeners outside the Bay Area, we have now a toll-free number at Poor Man's Radio. Now we can afford a 1-866-405-0200 that you can call us from outside.
Okay, but we're gonna end it here on Arab Talk today, and we're going to leave you with a poem from Suher Hamid about Palestine. Stay tuned next week on Arab Talk.
This is for Palestine and the rest of us in America. Right now, you are standing on stolen land. No matter where you are hearing this poem, I promise you, below you is stolen land. Was Lakota, was Navajo, was Creek, was, and is, and this fact does not change because you do not think about it, or you thought the last Indian died before you were born, or you were born 1/15th Apache. This poem is not blaming you, but allowing you an opportunity to do something. Start by saying something, and from where you are standing, look north. North, south, look west, look east, and see the theft, the occupation happening now, and do something. Start by saying something.